Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to the Damcasters, brought to you in association with the Pima Air and Space Museum. I'm your host, Matt Bone. The Lockheed SR-71 is probably one of the most recognizable aircraft in aviation history. It's up there with Concorde and Spitfire as an aircraft that almost anybody can pick out. Over the course of the last 35 years, author Paul Crickmore has been granted some remarkable access. I mean, this guy got to sit down and chat with Ben Rich about what was going on at Skunk Works. And all of that has made it into his books on the Lockheed Blackbird family, the latest of which is Lockheed Blackbird Beyond the Secret Missions, The Missing Chapters. And this book is absolutely stunning. It weighs a ton. And it is also Paul's last foray into the story of the Blackbird. So it was great to be able to sit down with him and reminisce about his time researching the aircraft and meeting the incredible men and women who kept it flying for all those years. So without further ado, let's get chatting with Paul about the Blackbird. You say you fell into this. How does a 35-year rabbit hole begin, sir?
Well, it began with my love for aviation, of course, which goes right back to when I was in the Air Training Corps as a young teenager. And it just continued from there. I saw 972 when it landed at Farnborough in 1974, and that was it, you know, hook, line and sinker, as they say, just to see that aeroplane and, you know, understand that it just flew across the Atlantic from New York to London in 1 hour and 55 minutes. I wanted to know more about it, you know, who wouldn't? And, you know, it's black and it looks, you know, sinister. At the same time, it looks beautiful. It's just it's an enigma, I guess, in many respects. I wanted to find out more, and there wasn't very much that you could find out about it. So, you know, sort of started digging, and that's kind of what happened. I was lucky when I was working in at London ATC in those days at West Drayton. Was able to get
up. I did actually visit West Drayton once.
Oh, did you? Yeah.
Yes.
Funny old place. Never went
down.
It had
a distinct smell. That's what I can remember.
Yes. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. And there's orange scopes and all of that good stuff in back in the day. But that allowed me an opportunity to get involved in flying on orientation flights. End quote. And consequently, I had jollies in all sorts of fast jets in the RAF and also with the US Air Force and quite a few air refueling KC-135 tanking trips and going taxiing back to the hard stand after one of them back in probably September 1981, past an SR-71, you know, that hadn't long started operating out of Mildenhall. And my escort officer was there to meet me when I jumped off the last step of the KC-135, and he wanted to know how it went. I said, yeah, I think I've got some good shots of some F-15s, which we refueled over Germany. And I said, but what's the chances of getting on a air refueling sortie of that one over there? And that was, you know, quite something different. Anyway, a long story short, I got a phone call one evening. I recognised his voice. It was an open phone line in those days. It all sounds very James Bond, doesn't it? And he said, can you get to Mildenhall Main Gate tomorrow at 6? And it was purely luck. It was a day off. So I said, yes. I said, can I bring my camera? And he said, yes. And then he put the phone down. And that was that. So off I went to Mildenhall and boarded a KC-135Q tanker, and we set off. Looking at the navigator's map up in the flight deck, it was generously stamped top secret all over it. And of course, now we can talk about this. You know, we went up into the Arctic Circle in the Viking North Air Refueling track off Bodø. And, you know,
I know Bodø well.
Uh-huh, yeah. Well, of course, several aeroplanes, as the program went on, had to divert into that very that very base for all sorts of technical reasons. But anyway, we were over the sea. Nothing external was particularly was classified about the aeroplane, so I was able to take lots of photos. The weather was perfect, even though it was October. Way up there, orientation of the track was great, illuminating the aeroplane brilliantly. You know, I mean, a fool could have taken the photographs. I was just lucky. I was in the right place at the right time, and got back on watch. And my dear friend Kev Gothard said, "You want to get these published?" You know, and anyway. Eventually, I sort of pulled my finger out and sent them off to Air Enthusiast. They published the photographs, four or five of them anyway, and asked if I wanted to write an article about the aeroplane. And I thought, well, I've never written an article before, but, you know, I'll have a go. I knew what and where the red lines were, so despite that, I sent it off to the deck commander, and it came back with only two or three sentences deleted. And anyway, they ran the article in two sections. And then Dennis Baldry from Osprey, the Dennis Baldry, wonderful, great guy, got in touch with me and said, you seem to know a lot about this aeroplane. No one's actually written a proper book about it. Do you fancy writing a book? I said, in my stupidity or, I don't know, supreme arrogance or whatever, I don't know what it was, possessed me really, but I said, well, yes, why not, you know, it's an opportunity. And that was that. I went over to Lockheed, to the Skunk Works. I spent a week there, 3 days with Ben Rich, which was absolutely incredible. A wonderful, wonderful man he really, really was. So bright, obviously, but so engaging and so down to earth. You know, he's a lovely guy. And they wheeled several test pilots in for me that to interview that were also involved in the early days of the SR program. And Dan Zuck, who designed the cockpit, and all sorts of... It was just amazing. Then I went on to Beale, and they made available to me, the first SRS made available to me, their scrapbooks. So obviously it was all stuff that's public domain, but it was all in one place. So, you know, so that was great. I was able to pull all bits and pieces up together from that. And anyway, that was the book that hit the mark in, I think, 1986. But of course, you know, as the years went by, more information became declassified, particularly after the program was cancelled, and that's what's kept these last books coming off the line, so to speak, as more and more information has become declassified.
Do you think there's more to come, or is it a case of operational stuff that's still classified? Do we know everything about everything we can know about the aircraft by now?
Well, there's nothing more to come from me, much to the delight of my long-suffering darling wife, Ali. I've said that.
And
that's
my postman, I'm going to reach over and bring it. Oh, goodness. It's a weighty tome, shall we say, Paul.
It is. A great doorstop. But, I know that there's a lot of classified information still about missions, really, that the US Air Force has. And it's just getting round to putting in Freedom of Information Acts to get it released. But it's all at Maxwell Air Force Base. So if anyone out there would like to carry on the baton where I've now left off and continue with, you know, mapping out the legacy of that amazing program and those incredible people that serviced the aeroplane, flew the aeroplane, used the intelligence that that aeroplane generated, then, you know, please, you know, it would be great to read some more about that, about Senior Crown, as it was called.
We're going to sort of break this down into a bit of a potted history about the aircraft. And then the section on maintainers, which I found absolutely fascinating. That's sort of going to be the breadth of this. But as I have you, and as we talked about this on the phone the other day, you have to tell me some Ben Rich stories. And I suppose we have to say, for those who may not have heard of him, who was he? Because he was a bit of a boy when it comes to wielding a pencil that becomes incredible airplanes, isn't he?
Yes. Well, absolutely. I mean, he was a thermodynamicist. He was Kelly Johnson's protege. And when Kelly became ill, Ben took over. And he went on to become really the father of stealth. The Have Blue and the platform that checked out the sort of stealth technologies that were then embedded into the F-117. That was all really down to him and his team at the Skunk Works. So a remarkable man.
You got to spend a good few hours with him. What was he like as a person, talking about the things he was allowed to talk about, even though he did allude to some of the things he probably shouldn't have?
Well, you know, as I say, he was quite a character. I mean, I went into his office, shook hands and sat down, the usual pleasantries, and then straight off the cuff he said, "Okay, Paul, so you've probably heard that we're building, we're building a very special aeroplane called a stealth aircraft. Well, I'll tell you here and now that those rumours are absolutely true." That was at a time I was completely unsolicited, you know. My jaw must have just swung open. We got, wow, you know, it's incredible. But it was interesting, though. He then went on to say, yeah, that there's been a heck of a lot of speculation, but on this I will say, those that know don't say, and those that say don't know. And I well remember, and I'm sure you do too, Matt, that plastic model made by the Testa Corporation of the F-117. And of course, you look at what the 117 actually looked like compared to the Testa model, and poles apart, you know. So he was absolutely right. Wherever Testa got their information from, it was certainly from no one that had anything to do with that program.
Because I remember Micropose made a early flight simulator F-19 stealth fighter that was of that Testa kit. Mm-hmm. That when the 117 was finally declassified, they basically just retconned the packaging and put a different picture on it, because it was sort of all sat inside, so you didn't really see out. So the two games are essentially the same, but then about a few years, because it was only, oh goodness, because that would have been late 80s, because then everything became very public 90-91, didn't it?
Gulf War, yeah. But I mean, it's interesting, because when Kelly Johnson got involved with the building a replacement for the U-2, because the U-2 was being tracked by Soviet radar, that really wasn't what Eisenhower wanted at all. And so the challenge was make U-2 stealthy, you know, invisible to radar. So they sort of called it radar camouflaging. Project Rainbow, as it was called. And so they tried to, yeah, make it stealthy. It didn't work. And so we had Project Gusto, which was, right, we're now going to build a replacement. Convair got involved as well, and they furnished some designs. Lockheed were declared the winner in August of 59, and the project then became Oxcart. And, of course, that was the forerunner of the SR-71, as we know. But whilst Kelly was drawing out A1, A2, A3, A4, up to A12, Archangel being the A standing for, initially, they didn't have the computer capacity to actually forecast how an incident radar wave would react when it hit an aeroplane. Particularly, nothing like, you know, that they did later on with the F-117 when that was around. They had computers with good processing power, and more importantly, they had computers and processors that were able to work incredibly fast, and therefore you were able to build an aeroplane that was completely unstable, but could be made stable because of the computers. And that's why, you know, you've got this merging of technologies at the right time. And, you know, the blended body concept, and as you look at the SR-71 today, and you can see certainly elements are, you know, there. And the materials along the wing fillets, sandwiched with epoxy and asbestos to soak up radar and not transmit the return signal. The fins canted in at 15 degrees to help knock out right angled, you know, triangles. You don't want that. So there are a lot of elements that you see when you look at the SR-71 that it was certainly going in the right direction. But,
I guess what we term a clean piece of paper design, because the U2 had a lot of sort of bitses, wasn't it? It was an F-104 body to a degree and things, whereas this couldn't be, just due to the nature of what it was required to do. I suppose, let's ask the basic question. Where did the spec for it come from? Was it a Air Force spec, or was it definitely a CIA intelligence request for an aircraft to be this fast and this exotic?
Yeah, it was. It was, you know, it was generated initially by the CIA as a replacement to the U-2. The U-2 was being operated by the CIA, civilians, in quotes, to overfly the Soviet Union. That's what it was to do. They realized that it had a limited shelf life and embarked upon, you know, the replacement of this airplane. And altitude, extreme altitude and speed really was at the heart of vehicle survivability, because you had, I think it was a 10-second time window for the SAM crew to actually use the Fansong radar to lock on, fire the missile to get up to the right altitude and in the right pocket of airspace that would meet this aeroplane 15 miles high. It was lomping along, a mile and a half every 2 seconds. So, you know, that's what made it survivable, really. I mean, when the Air Force started using it over Vietnam, it had no radar warning for an airborne threat, because, you know, when it flew its first sortie in March of 68, there was nothing up there that could get it, so it didn't need it, you know. And when they did finally put a roar on for air-to-air radars, to receive air-to-air radars as a threat alert, it was only to the front of the aeroplane, because, again, you know, in a tail chase, well, you couldn't have a tail chase, you know, it was impossible. So unless there was an aeroplane in front of you, had the ability to fire a missile head on, then it just wasn't going to happen.
it's one of those parts of the spec that always surprises me, that even after what had happened to Francis Carey Powers and things, there wouldn't have been that redundancy to have the ECM warning on the aircraft. Because I guess it seems elite. You know, we're too fast to catch, but then they thought it was too hot. You know, it's just one of those things that, as you know, in my business analyst head, you're like, well, hang on, that surely should be a requirement because it's something we learned over here. But it's just one of those strange quirks, I suppose, of these sorts of designs and these sorts of aircraft.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, and you alluded to really that you couldn't use stuff off the shelf, which they did with the F-117, you know, because as you rightly say, you know, the flight envelope was completely different. You know, Kelly often said everything on the SR, the A-12, YF-12, it was built, you know, from scratch, from the ground up. So it was titanium. And there are all sorts of interesting ways that the design team overcame the challenges of, for instance, how do you anchor some thin titanium skin to the hard sort of substructure of the wing without it tearing because of the differential of expansion between the two elements. And they used a standoff clip which acted as a heat shield so that the titanium skin didn't expand quickly and just tear against the rivets that were anchoring it to the substructure. You know, clever. You look at the wing, go down to Duxford and look at the wing area, especially of the aeroplane, and it's corrugated for the same reason. You know, you have a two-dimensional expansion and it will tear rivets and so on. However, you put a corrugation in it and all of a sudden it becomes a three-dimensional expansion issue, and all that happens actually is that the corrugations get deeper. So very clever, you know. In fact, you know, at one stage Kelly said, you know, people laugh at me and they say I'm trying to make a Ford tri-motor go Mark III. I just love things, you know, like that. The whole thing about the special fuel, because if you put normal fuel in it, it would explode in the tanks because you're going so fast. And of course, then you couldn't light the fuel, so you had to have a chemical ignition system to ignite the fuel. It just goes on and on, and it was just fascinating the hurdles that they had to overcome. Right back there in the day, without the amazing computer technology that we have available today, and it all worked incredibly well. Yeah, those speed records, you know, as I say, you know, an hour and 55 minutes across the Atlantic, it still stands today. It says a lot about the aeroplane.
Yes, and it's that problem solving, that sort of logical progression of we're going to encounter this, how do we overcome it? Well, it has to be built as titanium, but then all of this sort of very logical problem solving for something that is incredibly unorthodox normal sphere of the imagination. But you did mention it. There's this, when we talk about the Blackbird, it's really a series of aircraft, isn't it? So we're very familiar with the SR-71, but there was also a number of other variants of it as well. Yeah. So what were the other ones, I suppose, is the...
Yeah, yeah. That's a very fair
question. The easy way to put the question.
Yeah. The A-12, really. That was the one that really started the, in quotes, Blackbird ball rolling. The CIA contracted Skunk Works to build 12 single-seaters and one two-seat aircraft, as I say, operated by the CIA. And, of course, as you alluded to, Powers was shot down. Eisenhower said, right, there will be no manned flights, reconnaissance gathering flights over the Soviet Union. That's it. And that was upheld by other presidents that came along down the line. So the question then arose, well, what the heck are we going to do with this thing? You know, And along came the Cuban Missile Crisis. Another U2 fell victim of the SA-2. And by 64, it demonstrated all of the criteria, altitude, speed, endurance, capability. There were 13 airplanes up at Area 51 by then, four of which were designated to collect strategic reconnaissance from over Cuba, a program that was called Skylark. But there was a bit of disagreement, to put it mildly, between Joint Chiefs of Staff, Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, and DCI McCone, and the whole thing was kicked out because they thought that actually it would compromise the overall secrecy of the program. So that didn't happen. So eventually, long story short, they believed that surface-to-surface missiles were being supplied by the Soviet Union to the North Vietnamese. And so that's where it first cut its teeth in the skies over North Vietnam, trying to gather the strategic reconnaissance that would prove that these missiles were there. But in the process, we're getting incredible photography back of SAM sites, and the granularity of the film that the Perkin Elmer Type 1 camera was using, focusing via an 18-inch lens onto, say, this incredible negative. You could keep just blowing it up and up and enlarging and enlarging and get amazing detail. I mean, at Nadir, directly below the airplane, from 80,000 foot, the resolution was a foot. Going out to 3 to 4 foot, 35 miles either side of the airplane's track. So, you know, it was like an enormous Hoover taking these enormous sways, and the photo interpreters were able to drill down and, as I say, find the SAM sites, find out which ones were occupied, because this was the other thing. The North Vietnamese played this game. There were about six SAM sites to every SAM battalion, and so they would move them around. And so those guys that were charged with planning a strike the next day, you know, would have this data, which would, you know, give them a pretty good idea actually of which sites were occupied and which weren't. So, you know, but that was more of a tactical reconnaissance gathering exercise. And as I say, this is a sort of mission creep, really. So it was doing this, and quite rightly, the military out there, you know, really wanted that intelligence, but it wasn't what the CIA was kind of sort of contracted to do. It was initially to fly over the Soviet Union and gather strategic reconnaissance, you know, and there's quite a bit of difference. So I guess it's not altogether surprising that the US Air Force, you know, needed a similar platform because of, you know, the strategic the PSYOP. In the case of a nuclear war, you would need an aeroplane like that that would then overfly the Soviet Union, you know, as a precursor to Armageddon. So they needed an aeroplane like that. It was more capable because it had high-resolution radar that it could carry in the nose. The nose section on the SR was interchangeable. You could put a radar nose on it, or you could have a high-resolution panoramic camera in the nose. So it was very versatile. But because of all of this extra kit, you needed someone in the back to operate it. So it was a reconnaissance systems officer that sat behind the pilot in what was the Q bay, which on the A-12 carried this big old camera. So instead you had a guy in there working, you know, these systems. And that externally, if you like, was the major difference between the two to look at, between the A-12 and the SR. You had an extra body sitting behind the pilot. So there we had the SR, but of course there was three YF-12 fighter variants that were built, using a Hughes Pulse Doppler ASG-47 radar, which was incredibly accurate. Again, it demonstrated in tests that it could lock on at Mark 3 at 75,000 foot to a target at 1,500 foot over the sea. And it would have to lock on quick because of the closure speed, obviously, and fire its missile. And Jim Easton, who, again, I met through Ben Rich, who was the chief test pilot on the YF-12, said that on the evaluations, and I think there were five off the top of my head, where they fired dummy missiles over the sea at these targets, they would acquire the target like at extreme range, and by the time the missile had impacted, then the radar head was like right on its gunnel, you know, it's right looking right down at it because of the closure rate. So, but that was cancelled. Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense at the time, said it's very expensive, don't need it, you know, this is the age of missiles, and kind of going off track a little bit. That's why, you know, the Phantom didn't have a gun. The missile was going to do everything. So what do we need these incredibly expensive aeroplanes? I mean, they reckon that two wings of these aeroplanes, 96 aeroplanes in total, split 50-50 between the East Coast and the West Coast, would have been enough to completely defend continental North America. Quite a thought, but chopped expense.
We're going to take a quick break so that we can get the latest from the Pima Air and Space Museum with Head of Collections, Andrew Bowley.
Here at the Pima Air and Space Museum with our Fairchild A-10 Thunderbolt II, or Warthog. The A-10 was designed specifically as a tank buster ground attack aircraft. It's one of those aircraft that's kind of has a pretty good story. I mean, people either really love this aircraft because it's kind of unique. I mean, they got a titanium bathtub that the pilot's sitting in to protect him. Got a 30-millimeter Gatling gun that fires 4,200 rounds per minute, which means they can run out of ammo pretty quickly, short bursts. Could carry a slew of different types of weapons. And it's been upgraded over the years. These early A models had really kind of limited sensors and targeting equipment. It was kind of really kind of brute force. But over the years, they've upgraded them and made them more adaptable for night combat and firing more high-tech weapons. It's an aircraft that, to be fair, the Air Force has often tried to get rid of, which is why I think A-10 pilots are kind of a unique breed of pilots, because they kind of always feel like they're the ones that the Air Force is, you know, they're not flying the pointy bass jets and stuff like that. But, you know, in Desert Storm, and then again in the Middle East, the A-10 really proved itself. You know, the A-10 was often the aircraft that ground troops would call in specifically when they needed ground support. Sometimes just the A-10 coming in, firing its cannon in a quick burst was enough to disperse enemy forces. But, and also here in Tucson, Arizona, we are kind of what they consider the spiritual home for the A-10. Davis-Monthan Air Force Base has always been the training base and the big base for A-10s. That has allowed us over the years to, you know, foster a lot of good relationships with A-10 pilots. Another interesting exhibit we have here is the Bing, which is all the stuff that they brought back from Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan. They essentially had their own little pilots club. So all the patches that they would leave and unit memorabilia was brought back here for us to recreate a kind of display of their officers club. So the A-10 here is kind of the heart of our Arizona aviation exhibit for good reason.
To learn more about what is on display and what events are coming up at the Pima Air and Space Museum in Tucson, Arizona, please do check out their website at www.pimaair.org.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
And now, back to the show. But again, you sort of think about the numbers and you wonder if you're cutting it down to that many aircraft to have that level of defense. Surely getting rid of the hundreds of other aircraft might. Anyways, we're talking hypotheticals.
Yeah, sure.
McNamara was a very clever man, but had some very interesting ideas. His kid geniuses in Rand, certainly ran some interesting numbers, shall we say.
Yes, yeah, they did. The other aeroplane, of course, that we must mention, although, again, like the YF-12, and there are only two of these that were built, was the M-21 and the D-21. And so it was the mother-daughter combination. So you had an A-12 with a second seat in it with a launch control officer on it, and then you had a drone that sat on the back on a pylon, and you had to fly this thing. And again, through Ben, I was introduced to and spent a whole afternoon talking to Bill Park that flew these sorties. And it was an incredibly tight profile that they had to fly and had to do a pushover and maintain. It was something like 4/5 of a negative G. I mean, it's incredibly tight. At Mach 3.12 was what he told me to get the vehicle set, to get the separation for the drone then to go off. It had an inertial navigation system. It would fly around a predetermined area, again at Mach 3, tiny radar signature. Kelly was hoping for a resolution of the cameras of about 6 inches. Anyway, but it really didn't work out. It was very, very difficult to do. Kelly, I think the aeroplane actually first flew on the 22nd of December 64, the same day as the SR-71, in fact. And indeed, it flew from Area 51. And the VIPs and the Lockheed guys that went up to see it were late getting back to Palmdale to see the SR-71 undertake its first flight. Anyway, that's by the by. But on the fourth flight, when they were launched, actually, there was only four occasions when they actually successfully launched this thing off the mother ship. It collided into the back end and the whole aeroplane completely disintegrated. Incredibly, Bill Park survived, and Torrick actually got out in one piece, but he drowned. He couldn't inflate his life preserver, and his space suit, his pressure suit, filled with water. This is a horrible, horrible, you know, waste after surviving something like that. You know, Ben said there was like a 50-cent clip that he just couldn't unclip, and that was the result. But so that was cancelled on the 30th of July 1966 after that accident, and they then started to fly the D-21s off of B-52s, specially modified a couple of B-52s, but again it really wasn't a successful program, and funnily enough it too got cancelled after the fourth operational flight over the People's Republic of China. It just really wasn't working out. getting the reconnaissance package back. There were all sorts of problems and everything else. And by that time, Corona was starting to get results. So, you know, it really wasn't very cost effective. I think it was 5.5 million in 1970 money that the program, you know, cost. And it was the lack of success that, yeah, come the 23rd of July 1971, it was chopped.
Am I thinking right that the Corona satellite program was also Lockheed?
Yeah, they made the rockets. Yeah. Yes, yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah. Nothing like having wheels within wheels, is there?
Diversification, I think they'd call it these days. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I got to see one of the surviving D-21s out at Pima. It's a fascinating thing. It looks like something out of Stingray, the old cartoon. And it is pretty, but it looks very, almost cartoonish. I keep coming back to those sort of Gary Anderson designs for those sort of shows, and it was quite something to see. But to think that to launch that off the top of a Blackbird as well, goodness, must have seemed like a good idea on paper.
This is it. Yes. Yeah. excuse me. Yeah. The practicalities of it all.
Let's get on to that section of your book that I, funnily enough, when I saw it in the table of contents, I went straight to it because we spend a lot of time talking about operations of aircraft and the thought that goes into it. Goodness, we've spent a half hour. talking about that, but you've got a section in there about the maintainers and keeping the Blackbirds flying, and it's interesting as well considering they were in use a lot as well. So with only 50 aircraft flying, keeping them going, keeping them in the air was quite a trial. And I was quite surprised at some of the times between heavy checks and things. But where were they being maintained? For the main part, was it in Nevada, or was there another specific detail that they were doing the heavy work on?
Okay, well the A-12s were absolutely up at Area 51. That's where they everything happened there, apart from Black Shield when they went to Kadena to fly against. And then there was a limited amount of maintenance. The idea was that they would be there for a certain period of time and then they would fly back for more deeper maintenance. But that never happened because there's the same three aeroplanes that stayed there for the year. I mean, the aeroplane only flew 29 operational sorties in a year before it was chopped. So, we never really got into talking about deep maintenance as far as the A-12 was concerned. But as far as the SR was concerned, then that's a different thing. Now, one of the things that people don't quite appreciate is there wasn't enough money in the kitty to have them all up and running every day of the week. So there would be a premium authorized aeroplane, so there would only be a certain number. So, for instance, when they were operating at Detachment 1 over in Kadena, Detachment 4 at Mildon Hall, and at Beale Air Force Base, the home base, they might have the two-seater at Beale and maybe two, three other aircraft as well there. At the height of the Vietnam War, they actually had four SR-71s operating for a brief time out of Kadena, but that went down to three, and so that it tended to be three for most of its lifetime, although towards the end, the last few years, it went down to two. And we know in this country, two aeroplanes operating out of Mildon Hall. So what are we looking at? So say two, four, probably eight aeroplanes that were financed, if you will, to operate at one time. And again, the complexity that we were talking about earlier, Matt, on these aeroplanes, initially they would it required about 720 man hours per flight hour because of the complexity of the systems. Yeah, that's how you know, difficult and, you know, how demanding they were to keep the things up. That actually was, you know, cut back as time went on, and I think they got it down to about 150 hours per flight hour as time went on, and they had different systems that came in, DAFIX, digital automatic system for the spikes and all that sort of thing. So so that was the one thing. And then when it went into deep maintenance, I mean, it would take about 8 or 9 months for an aeroplane to go through that. So they would rip out all the sealant, the fuel sealant, because they were wet tanks. So they would rip all that out and it would be resealed. I mean, it was a real thorough job and expensive. So that was one major resource, and that was conducted at Palmdale. You also had guys out at out in the field, U.S. Air Force maintenance crews, who were, you know, doing the non-deep maintenance that was going on at Palmdale, and then they brought up quite an interesting thing that I'd never heard of before, the Blue Streak team, and they were like specialist troubleshooters that could almost, you know, that could do carry out far more demanding maintenance actually in the field than regular US Air Force guys. And the first time I found out that they actually used the Blue Streak team was in September 1974, when an aeroplane 976 got airborne from Kadena, and one of the engines hadn't had the keepers put in place for the compressor section. One of these blades, they had an engine, had an unstart actually, and then that particular engine then caught fire, causing quite a bit of fire damage, and it was on a functional check flight, so Rosenberg, the pilot, got it down and into Kadena really quickly, and it was this specialist team, the Blue Streak team, that went out and got it to a state where it could be flown back to Palmdale, you know, for the thing to be stripped right back. And
I think that's the thing that we need to call out as well, because normally you think of maintenance, engine fire. I was on shift one time when one of our brand new A320s shed a compressor blade, and you shut it down, you put another one on a truck, and a couple of days later your airplane's back. These things are really two engines in one, aren't they? Because you mentioned unstart, and I think that's an interesting thing to discuss, because that's not a phrase you'd hear very often when we talk about an aircraft operation.
Yeah. So I guess to be accurate, you should call it an aerodynamic disturbance. But unstart is the term that, you know, everyone has anything to do with the SR-71 is what they call it. Okay, so pressure at sea level, 27 pounds a square inch, roughly. Up at 80,000 foot, it's about a quarter of a pound per square inch. Okay, so a jet engine needs air. If you look at the SR-71, it has these spikes that stick out of the nacelle. As the aeroplane accelerates above, I think it's Mach 1.2, they unlock and they start going backwards. As they do so, if you can imagine it, they are conical in shape. As they go back, the surface area of that intake increases. So the tube of air that is going into that nacelle is increased by over 100%, something like 110%. The capture area has increased. However, as that spike retracts even further, the throat, the distance between the surface of the spike and the interior surface of the inlet gets smaller. And so you have this constriction. And of course, you know, when you put your thumb over a bicycle pump and you push it and you can feel the heat build up as the pressure builds up, much the same thing happens in that inlet. So that the pressure in there, it gets really hot because it has been compressed. And the aeroplane that a lot of people say, how fast can SR-71 go? Well, it had a CIT compressor inlet temperature red line at 426 degrees centigrade. Okay, so it shows you just how hot that air got in that intake, despite the fact that it was about minus 60 degrees Celsius outside of the intake. You know, so that was
and that's a temperature differential in a matter of feet, isn't it?
About 18 feet. Yeah, about 18 foot. You're absolutely right, Matt. Yeah. So, the problem is that hot air got exponentially hotter for every 1 degree over that 126 degrees C. So you then started to get incredibly high temperatures at the back end, and that's where you'd start causing a lot of damage, you know, to your turbine blades and all that sort of thing. So that's that part of it. But now to return to the unstart. So you had this air inside the intake, which was allowed then to expand, okay, but you had a pressure differential of about 14 pound a square inch inside the inlet compared to a quarter of a pound a square inch outside. So basically what was happening is the aeroplane was being sucked, and that's what Ben Rich he described it to me. It's actually sucking the intake along, and you had various bypass doors to manage the flow of that air throughout the nacelle and engine area, which is fine until it was disturbed in some way, and then that pressure recovery in the inlet would be belched out forward of the intake, so you'd lose all of that thrust instantly. And, of course, Kelly Johnson, being the genius that he absolutely was, foresaw that this could happen. And thought, well, if that happened, it would be game over. The aeroplane would pitch up, flip over, disintegrate, and that would be it. So as soon as there was an unstart in one engine, the other one would automatically run the spike forward and purposefully, if you like, unstart, so you didn't have this enormous asymmetric thrust issue going on, with one engine developing full power and the other one not. So that's how they got it. But that was the unstart. It was where you lost all that pressure recovery in the inlet. I hope, does that make sense?
It does. And that's, you know, the amount of time that all of that would happen as well, especially when you've got an aircraft that's able to accelerate as it does. You wouldn't have been, there would have been no way for a pilot to recover with that asymmetrical thrust, as you're saying. And a few were lost due to engine issues, weren't they?
Yeah. Actually, the first SR-71 that was lost, I met again Ben Rich at that meeting at Skunkworks, Bill Weaver, and his backseat, Jim Sway, was the test engineer. They were on a flight in aeroplane 952, and they were putting, they were, as I say, they were Lockheed test crew. They flew with the they were having problems with the aeroplane going out in supersonic. They were using up a vast amount of fuel at transonic area. And so they flew with the center of gravity slightly further aft than normal. And when the center of pressure moved aft as well, and they were in a slight bank at 75,000 foot at Mach 3, boom, they had an unstart. And the thing pitched up and disintegrated. And actually, again, a bit like the case with the MD-21, the drone and the drone incident, both guys got out. And what is really weird, and even to this day they're not sure exactly how it happened, is they found the ejector seats in the wreckage, but both guys got out. And they think what happened was when the aeroplane pitched up, the aerodynamic forces on the underside of that fuselage, which that long fuselage forebody snapped off. They then think there was like a ram air effect, literally going through the aeroplane. And as it pitched up, the handles for pulling the canopies off, for if there's a problem, an emergency on the ground, for the fire crew to pull the canopies off. They think when it pitched up, it ripped what they call that chine, which held those handles in place, off. That blew the canopies off. The air going up the back end then blew the guys out and through, you know, an open canopy space. And of course, they had the parachute on. They had a full space suit, so it inflated to protect them, to stop their blood boiling because of Boyle's law and, you know, pressure diffraction and all of that. And Jim Zweier was killed. He had a broken neck on the aeroplane disintegration. Bill survived. The front, you know, pilot survived. But, yeah, that was a painful lesson in what an unstart, you know, can do. But, of course, as time went on, they had a digital automatic flight inlet control system, which is a software package that Tom Tilden and a couple of others really developed, made by Honeywell. And it really cured the unstart problem. You know, computers can sense things and react to them so quickly that it virtually, you know, it was an end to these things, this phenomena.
And this is, I suppose, the other thing, which is probably an obvious thing to say, but we'll call it out anyways, is this is the first time non-specialist test aircraft are regularly operating in this environment, isn't it? You have a number of aircraft operating in a region that before which you're talking about specialist sort of NASA aircraft and test aircraft that are dabbling. And I suppose possibly the only one that could maybe sits in the same sort of category. You're talking X-15, aren't you? We're in that sort of rarefied space of that altitude, that speed, and regularity at it.
Yeah, but the big thing, I think, that even separated again this, here I am, of course, aren't I, waving the flag in the SR.
That's why you're here.
It was sustained. This was the big thing. You know, during the Yom Kippur War in 73, the plan was to fly an SR. They moved it two aeroplanes temporarily to Griffiths Air Force Base from Beale, and it would fly. The idea was it would fly across the Atlantic, through the Straits of Gibraltar, into the war zone, and then back and recover into Mildenhall. The Heath government at the time said, "No. We don't want that thing landing here. We want to kind of stay neutral. We want to show our friends that produce oil that we're good people, and we want to maintain the flow of oil. So no, we're not going to allow it." And of course that backfired anyway, because they chopped the oil supply to us in any event. So what happened?
Poor Ted always tried to play both sides against the middle, didn't he?
Absolutely. Yes, you can't please all the people all the time. And so what happened is, they flew over the war zone, over Israel, Egypt, Syria, and then back again and landed back at Griffiths. So they did it non-stop, you know. I think it was something like over 5 hours at Mark 3. So, I mean, you know, and of course they were having to slow down. So, I think there were, let me see, 5 air refuelings that they would have to, you know, slow down, descend, fill up the tanks, accelerate. So incredibly demanding flights, you know, really amazing. And the guys were virtually having to be lifted out of the cockpit, you know. Mm. You can imagine, can't you? All that time in spacesuits, you know, with those demands.
And there's not really any creature comforts in it as well, is it? There's, you know, they're they're having to make do with, you know, the calls of nature and thing in a very tight space, in a spacesuit that they can't undo too much of, just in case something goes wrong.
Yeah, you wouldn't want. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. They had a thing, a UCD, a urine collection device, which they would pee into, and so that was quite funny actually. A chat that I know, Dave Dempster. In the early days of the SR program, was him and John Story, who was an absolute legend, who was the pilot. They were doing a round States flight, and Dempster said, you know, I've just got to pee. I he was absolutely bursting. And so Story says, well, look, I look at it this way. You can either hold it or you just let it go into your suit. And this is the earlier, and Dempster hadn't had his pressure suit measured up before it was being sorted out by the David Clark Company. You know, they were all tailor-made back then. And so Story said, by the way, Dave, whose pressure suit are you wearing? Colonel Doug Nelson. And that was all that he needed to make sure he held it until he landed. That was the motivation that was needed, you know, not to pee in the colonel's pressure suit. But you're right. So that was and then, of course, if they needed any kind of sustenance, they had a hole in the side of the helmet with a rubber non-return valve, so you had this tube and a straw in it that you poke through it, and you know, you could suck this stuff like apple pie or what, all sorts of, like, in fact it was made by Gerber, the same people that made the baby food. It's the same company. So you'd have these, you'd be feeding, you know, on this thing. And one pie, I can't recall who it was now, once told me on one occasion, just as he was taking the straw out of the helmet, a little bit of food residue pinged up and stuck on his chin. And there it had to remain, you know, until they landed. Because, you know, again, you really didn't want to open your face visor for the same reason, you know, as you mentioned, you know, if you had a rapid decompression, you know, well, you know, you that was it. Yes.
I'd always, as someone sort of growing up and you're blown away by flying, the technology behind it and things. It's when the realities of these things, like First World War engines being lubricated with castor oil, you know, you suddenly think when you're a little bit older, that must have been a little bit less Knights of the Sky, my dear old chap, once you got back on the ground. And and likewise with things like this, which you think, oh, that's an incredible thing. And then you think, how do they go to the loo? And you end up finding stories and very, very strange YouTube videos, of which now this is one, as we'll put things. Now that we've brought bodily function into this, I suppose we should get serious and wrap it up, because this has been fascinating. And dear listener, I have the book open in front of me, and I've been sort of flicking through as we've been chatting. Osprey have done an incredible job. It is a beautiful, beautiful book. The words are fantastic as well. Let's just throw that in. I can thoroughly recommend it. Your postman will hate you because it does weigh a literal ton. But the program came to an end in the 90s. There's a line in your book where you said that Kelly Johnson thought the Blackbird could probably continue into the 21st century. U2's still going.
Yeah.
Do you think that could have been possible with the right backing for it? I suppose, given the massive changes that happened around the turn of the 90s, the will for it was very different. But would it have been possible to have kept going for another decade or so?
Yeah, I honestly believe, and having talked to people, you know, that were in the program, that went to the Pentagon and were doing all sorts of stuff, you know, Blackwell stuff, who knew about, I mean, they had developed an electro-optical system for the cameras, the advanced synthetic radar aperture radar that was used for ground mapping, built by Laurel, that was digitized. So all of that actually could be fed, because it was digitized information, to a data link. And actually, when the airplane was chopped and then came back for like 2 years, only to operate in the States because the powers that be didn't want it back. But it demonstrated that it could do this. It could do it all in real time. And so, yeah, I think it was chopped 5 years, certainly, too early. Because, again, about a year or so after the program was cancelled and you had Gulf War One, one of the SR pilots, I mean, they were all, because they were guilty by association of being in the SR program when it was chopped, most of them were given jobs that were way below their ability level. That's why a lot of them just left and flew, you know, and went to the airlines. But Mac, chose to stay on for a bit. So he flew EF-111s during Gulf War One, and he was using that aeroplane's electronic systems to keep the RF-4s that were gathering the reconnaissance safe. And he said it took so many missions. And he said, you know, not taking it away from those RF-4 pilots, they did an amazing job. He said, but we could have done it on our own in one sortie, where these guys, you know, it would take 8, 9, 10 sorties to get the coverage that was wanted. So, you know, that proved it. But I think the thing was, you know, between 1947 and 1982, you had 10 chiefs of staff. They were all ex-SAC. From July 82, it was fighter guys from the fighter stables. And there was a different, you know, approach. And that was the thing, I think. That was the big difference.
Which is one of the reasons why that F-117 is called the stealth fighter, isn't it? When it's not a fighter.
It's never a fighter. At all. Yes.
It's,
yeah,
just, you know, it's to keep the powers of B happy.
Yeah, I know. Crazy old world, isn't it, Matt?
Totally. Paul, this has been a delight, and we could keep going forever, because frankly, every time I randomly open a page, I go, oh, I want to talk about that. But we have been chatting for a while, and I must keep you in line. But what's, after all this time with you hanging up your Blackbird hat now, what's your sort of lasting memory of your journey with this aircraft and meeting the incredible crews and maintainers and designers? Mm-hmm. What's your lasting memory that sort of makes you smile as you look back over the last 35 years?
I mean, photographing the aeroplane when it was on an operational mission. And I went on a training mission some years later in another 135 from Beale. But air-to-air photography, great. But to be honest with you, Matt, it is the people. The people that I met because I got in, you know, I got involved in this journey have enriched my life. I can say that in all honesty, hand on heart. They really have. They are an amazing bunch of people. Every person involved was at the top of their game. They had to be to get into it. And, yeah.
What a perfect place to leave it. Paul, thank you so much. This has been so much fun. And I think I'm going to have to pop up to Duxford just to see her again, because this
great.
I now know a lot more about it.
Great idea. I'll see you there, Matt.
Fantastic. It's a day. I'll buy the teas.
Okay, you're on.
Yes, super. Thank you so much, Paul.
Great pleasure. Thank you, Matt.
I cannot thank Paul enough for joining us here on the Damcasters. And if you're listening to this on the day of release, Paul's book is out today. Day in the UK from Osprey Publishing, and many thanks to them for sending over the review copy, which my postman literally complained about when he handed it over to me, because it weighs a ton. There is a lot in there, and it is absolutely beautiful. The layout and the imagery and the data that's in it, Paul has done a remarkable job putting this all together. So if this is really his last book on the Blackbird, it has been worth the wait. You can grab a copy from our very own bookshop, where 10% of every purchase goes to support the pod. If you're in the US and Canada, the book is out in December, so please check all your local good and evil bookshops for that one. I'd just like to say thanks to everybody for their continued support of the pod. New listeners are joining us all the time, so thank you so much for that. Telling your friends is the best way to get this pod spread around, out from the underground and into the mainstream. Who knows? But if you could give us a review, pop some stars into your podcast app of choice, like and subscribe on YouTube. All of those good things help the algorithms, because the algorithms rule the world along with the AIs. And I, for one, welcome our new AI overlords, if they're listening, which they probably are. Of course, if you'd like to support the pod in another way, you can join us and become a Damcasteer on Patreon for just £3 a month plus a bit of VAT to start with. For just £3 a month plus a bit of VAT, you get these episodes early with new intros and outros, and you'll be able to hear our next episode with Colonel George Sonny Holt Jr., US Air Force, retired. He flew on the B-58 Hustler as a bombardier navigator, and we do some myth-busting about why just about everything on the Wikipedia page about the Hustler is wrong. So, until next time, thank you ever so much for your continued support. Do take care of yourselves. Bye-bye. The Damcasters is hosted and produced by Matt Bone and is a Bony Abroad podcast production. To learn more about our podcasts and check out our previous episodes, head to www.thedamcasterspod.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.